Live from Music City, Nashville, Tennessee. Two guys fumbling their way through the music business so you don't have to. Here they are. It's Scott and it's Hino and the Music Row Show.
All right, all right. Hello, friends, and welcome to the Music Row Show on a beautiful Sunday. Oh, my gosh, the sun's finally shining.
It is beautiful.
It's fantastic.
I love it.
My name is Scott.
And my name is Hino. Thanks so much for tuning in again tonight. We love it that you're here with us. As you probably know by now, this show is for all you songwriters and musicians and performers out there across the country who are just trying to get a handle on things here in Music City.
That's right. Now, we don't really know anything.
No, we don't
have any answers.
We don't.
We're out there slinging songs during the day, just like all y'all. But we are able to find the right people, bring them into the studio, pick their brains, and give you the opportunity to join in the conversation.
That's right. And you can do that by going to Facebook.com/TheMusicRowShow or Twitter @TheMusicRowShow or even mail@TheMusicRowShow.com. You got lots of ways to chime in with your questions, so there's really no excuse for sitting this one out.
Are we on the Twitters?
We are on the Twitters, yeah.
I'll be darned.
At the Music Row Show.
Okay. Hey. Well, good.
So we got a really cool show tonight, don't we?
Yeah, I think so.
We got Golden Globe and Grammy-nominated songwriter and performer Frank Stallone here with us right now.
Yeah, and then we're going to welcome songwriter, producer, and adjudicator Cliff Goldmacher in hour two.
You make him sound like a judge. Adjudicator.
Adjudicator.
All right, Scott, why don't we get to it? Why don't you introduce this gentleman we got sitting here with us?
All right. Sit back and listen to this. Once upon a time in Maryland, a little boy gets a guitar, and life's good. A few years later, he starts a band. He and some guy named Bruce Springsteen start playing around the same circuits in New York City. Labels want to sign his band. He hires his out-of-work actor brother as a roadie every now and then. Life's good, you know. Everything's cooking. One day, he and his band help his brother out in a little scene in a low-budget movie, and then the whole world just kind of explodes. He's been responsible for songs that were really part of an entire generation soundtrack. Four platinum albums, 10 gold
wow.
albums, 5 gold singles, and oh yeah, he's acted in a bazillion movies and TV shows. He was in Tombstone. Did you know he was in Tombstone?
I did know that.
That's a great movie.
I did know that.
Yeah, you were. You were. You were terrific in it, too.
Thank you.
I think you got shot, though. I got bad news
for
you. No,
I got stabbed, so I'm good for the sequel.
All right.
Everyone
good.
Else is dead, but...
yeah.
Tombstone, the sequel.
The Ed Bailey saga. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Tombstoner.
We got a lot to talk about. It's a pleasure to say Frank Stallone. My goodness, welcome to the Music World.
Well, right. Thank you. Thank
glad
you.
You're here.
Thank
nice.
You for having me here.
So, you grew up in Philly.
Well, I actually grew up in Maryland.
Maryland?
My mother got divorced for like the fourth time. Then we moved to Philadelphia. And
okay.
Then after that, I was going back and forth to Maryland and Florida and just traveling all around.
But when you grew up, you were mostly in the your teenage years.
Maryland.
You were in the Maryland area.
Maryland.
What was the music scene like there, and what were you doing musically at that time?
Well, you know, Maryland is kind of south of the Mason-Dixon line. So Maryland was there was a lot of country music. I mean, Jimmy
really?
Dean started there. Jimmy
oh, okay.
Dean used to have a show out there, Jimmy Dean Show.
Nice.
And Roy Clark played guitar because he was from nearby Virginia.
Nice.
And of course, you know, the rock scene, you know, everything that was going on was
sure.
you know, Gene Vincent, Elvis, and everything like that. So we had that array of everybody. And, you know, but by the time the Beatles hit, I was in Philadelphia at that point. But I guess the early stuff was Everly Brothers. Mm. And, you know, there was still, you know, again, you know, you're excuse me, across the bridge from Virginia. So, you know, it's a kind of a southern state more than a northern state.
Ish. But were there places to play? I mean, what was the
well, I was
scene
a little
like?
Too young at that point, but I came back. I did most of my playing as a professional more in Philadelphia at that
okay.
point. Yeah.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Then Florida. Well, Florida.
Florida's good.
Florida's good.
Sunnier.
Sunnier.
So, how old were you when you got that first guitar?
Well, I got the first guitar, I think they were ukuleles, I was about 8. And they lasted a day. My brother and I elka-bonged each other, and that was it. But we
yeah.
always had a guitar hiding in a closet. No one in my family was musical, except my grandfather was a really good violinist. But I didn't really get to know him too much. So I was always singing. I mean, I was always singing first. And then the guitar playing came later. you know, like when I was like 12, 13, then, you know, the lessons, and then the Beatles hit, and that was it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, did you actually go take formal lessons, or was it mostly self-taught? Yeah,
I did, but I think now, when I look back on it, because I couldn't remember anything, it was definitely ADD. No one knew what that was then, you know, so. I couldn't remember anything. So I just started writing my own songs and just things like that. But I know friends of mine that can sight read anything, but couldn't write a note if you hit a song if you held a gun to their head. So
wow. Yeah.
So that's the way it is. Listen, Irving Berlin couldn't read a note of music. He didn't do too bad.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
There's a lot of guys in this town who don't
read. Glenn Campbell couldn't read a note of music. George Benson can't read a note of music. So I think it's either in your soul. I believe, honestly, I was born to do it because I could just sing when I was a little kid.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't have to go like the voice lessons. I never did that.
You just did.
I went to voice lessons once and it ruined me for like 2 months.
Really?
Because all of a sudden you're
they're trying to make you sing opera-like or something. Yeah.
Yeah, like I'm sitting there playing, you know, we're drunk on stage. I'm sitting there holding my stomach. I said, I don't think so. So
it's not for you.
Not for me.
Not for you. Well, give us a peek at Valentine in the early days, because I read that John Oates was in the band too.
Yes, he was.
Hall & Oates.
Yeah.
By the way, congratulations.
Rock
and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yes,
that is awesome.
Deservedly so, since they're considered they are the highest selling duo in the history of music.
Yeah.
So they should have been in like 15 years ago.
Yeah.
I think they had a little edge over Run DMC. I don't know what happened.
That's crazy talk.
Yeah. Jimmy Cliff, I don't think so, pal, okay? Jimmy Cliff, you go into the reggae, whatever they have there.
Do they have one?
The Reggae Marijuana Hall of Fame.
There you go.
It's in Colorado now, isn't it?
Yeah. The Reggae Spliv Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
No, but anyway, I mean, I met Daryl. I had a group called Valentine, and I met Daryl when he was still in Temple University. And my bass player, John, said, why don't you come down and we need a keyboard player. So he came down. He's a real handsome guy. You know, really, he was a little older than me. He's like more my brother's age. He said, wow, you guys sound great, but I got to make a living. Well, obviously, my band was not making a living. You know, you're playing your own music. So it was like, you know, forget it. You play in a coffee house, they give you like a cup of tea. You know,
that's
it. And he was getting married. So he bowed out because he had to go on. But in 1970, John Oates joined a group. Now, he was in the group, and he was just a wonderful guy. He still is a wonderful guy, very warm, very nice person. And they had been friends since Temple University. So, you know, it was really interesting because they turned down. I can't. We just cross-pollinate. Like, they turned down Staying Alive, the movie.
Oh,
and I got it.
Oh, that's awesome.
And they wanted them to write for Rocky, and they turned it down. And I got it. So it's like, I became successful off their rejects.
Well, what was the idea of Valentine? What was your guys' goal? I mean, was it always original music?
Oh, yeah. We were into like the Buffalo Springfield, the Youngbloods, Moby Grape, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
More that, you know, folk rocky, the Birds, totally into that stuff. So that's what we did. We weren't really into, we listened to Motown. I mean, it was great. That wasn't our thing. We'd throw one of those songs in once in a while to make people happy, but kind of wanted to do our own stuff. I mean, I was looking at this way. I was a lousy student. I was a good person to have in school, but I sucked as a student. So I figured, well, I think I'm in for the long haul. You know, we're always talking about college. I go, what are you kidding? I can't even pass Algebra 1, college.
Yeah.
I mean, I walked in ninth grade. I saw the algebra book and it was symbols. I go, what are you out of your mind? So it was like 4 years of Rain Man. I had no idea. I said, I don't need this. I'm a musician. Yeah. How much you pay me? 150, 200? You know, minus. That's why I need, like a bookie.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you know? Hey, listen, man, you cut me short by pi square. Okay?
I'm going to make you look like an isosceles.
That's triangle. Right, man. Don't mess with the isosceles here.
That's funny.
So, yeah, I don't need a dangling participle, okay? Well, Frank, you know, that lyric, you know, that paraphrase. Does it sound good? Yeah, I said, shut up. Just play, you know,
that's
rhymes.
It
works. That's all.
That's all that matters.
I mean, you think with the Harlan Howard and go, you know, you got a dangling participle there. He goes, oh, where is it? So let me get rid of it. You know, like with a toothpick or something. So
when you were playing, I read you were in another interview I was reading up on you, and you were saying that when you were playing on corners in New York, mm-hmm. how were you, I mean, was that something that was profitable? Could you make a living doing
that? Well, considering I had no other skills, yes. I mean, I think my rent was $30 a week.
Yeah.
And I was staying at the Hotel Sutton. And at first, my brother and I shared one room, and there was a bathroom in the hallway. I mean, the room was really, really small.
Yeah.
He'd sleep on the bed. I'd sleep on the floor. Next day, we didn't have a refrigerator. Put everything outside the window. So so I started playing a guitar on the street corner. And I mean, it was cold, man. I'm talking this winter.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I would draw crowds. I still have that same guitar.
That is awesome. Gibson, what guitar was it?
It's a Gibson J50. I still have that guitar. Yep. If you look at my one of my albums, songs from, not the other one, whatever it is. But I have it on the cover. And I've had that guitar since. And it's amazing when people like baby their guitars. I said, I was playing this guitar in sub-zero weather and it still plays. Right?
Yeah.
He goes, hey, I don't want to mess with my old Les Paul. That's what it's made for.
That's made to play.
Beat it up. Let it fall down. Who cares? But so I'd stand on a street corner and my brother would come by. Of course, nobody knew who we were. We're 20, you know.
Yeah.
And he'd throw some money, what money we had, into the guitar case.
To kind of get it going. Like get seed it, money. Yeah, get
kinda,
it going.
Kind of get it going. And so I'd be playing there, and sometimes I might make, I mean, $9. But that's a lot of money when you're broke.
Yeah.
And I remember one day he came by, and then he came by like an hour, 3 hours later with some chick he picked up. And he stuck his hand in and took the money.
We're going to dinner.
I said, yeah, dinner. Right. Dinner. I said, Jesus. You know.
Thanks.
And yeah, thanks, man. And he still does that. Anyway. But the way my career might be going, I could still. No, but anyway. So we did that. And then I got a job at Bloomingdale's selling shirts. I had no idea what I was doing at all. None. But the dream, you know, I would go into the village and, you know, open mic nights were all the time. Nothing like here. This is magical. I mean, this is just filled with songwriters. In New York, it was different. I mean, you know, we sit there and go to open mic, but it wasn't like you're going to get the right with Carole King or, you know, Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil. Here, you could be in a hotel with a singer. You never know who comes walking.
You really don't, right? Yeah.
And that's what's the magic of this town. And my father used to break my chops. Hey, you should go to Nashville. Like in the 70s.
Really?
Oh, all the time, constantly. I said, man, I don't know, man. My hair is too long. They might, like, kill me. This was like in 1970. But maybe it wasn't at the time. I'm sure it was a little different in 1970 than it is now. I think it's probably a little more open to outside songwriters. And I don't think I was probably really mature enough at that point.
You might have gotten here right around the Chris Gantry Christopherson time, though. I think that might have been kind of a cool thing.
Absolutely. I'd probably be dead, though.
You'd have that
like four liver transplants by that time.
So now, okay, so you're in New York, but was that help me try to figure out this whole timeline? Is that before Valentine? That's
yeah. There was a Valentine in high school.
Okay,
and then there was a Valentine in 1970. That's with John Oates, and then after that, I said, okay, I'm going to New York. Then okay. I stayed, but then I went to Florida for a while and I played. Jerry Jeff Walker was down there, mm-hmm. Coconut Grove, Florida. It was a very hip scene, so it was a nice place to be. And then I came back to New York and got the stupid job at Bloomingdale's. I mean, I had no idea what I was doing.
Yeah,
selling custom shirts. I owned one shirt. And I'm telling people in the most expensive, exclusive store in the United States. Hey, maybe you should try this look. And they're okay, idiot. You know, his hair tucked into his collar because it was too long. Okay. Bad clothes, everything bad. So and then I hooked up with two friends of mine, Bob Tanner, who used to be at the Tanner Brothers, magnificent mandolin player and singer and guitar player and fiddle player, and my other friend Jody, who was in a group, and we got together, and that was the excuse me. That was the third and final version of Valentine that was on RCA Records.
Okay.
And we were together for like 6 or 7 years. That was the Rocky. Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The Take You Back.
Yeah.
Take You Back.
And we were living in the kind of really in Trenton, New Jersey, which is kind of the orifice of the East Coast. It's pretty bad. Yeah. I have no idea why you go be creative there. You're like saying, hey, I really want to learn to write. Let me go to Kuwait. Yeah, that's supposed to be something like that.
Hey, we got to take a break. This segment was brought to you by the Trenton Tourism Bureau. We love it there, and we know you will too. Stick around. We'll be right back with more of Frank Stallone here on the Music Row Show. All right, welcome back to the Music Row Show.
No one believes that's me when I play it.
That is you. That is Frank Stallone doing a song called Day In and Day Out.
Yeah.
Hey, love that.
It's a long story behind that.
Can I just make a bet?
Yeah.
I bet this has never played on WSM.
No, I don't.
It is now.
Yeah. Country Music, the home of the Grand Ole Opry.
I love it.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to go in your top country chart.
That's all right.
Okay, we're going to have David Allen Coe sing.
I had a blast at the house earlier today, and the kids were dancing like crazy. Wonderful. They loved it.
You know, I there's a story about behind that. After I had the big success with Staying Alive, I had a solo album that we thought was going to go really, really well. And, I had really lousy management then, like most artists do. And usually you get 3-album deal when you have a number one record and stuff like that. But anyway, right. I said, well, let me do something that no one my age is doing. So I did these big band albums.
Yeah.
I did one with Billy May and one with Sammy Nestico. And I figured, well, this will make me more or less like an alternative group because no one's doing it. So if Grammys come around, I got open road. Because I have no competition.
Right.
Unless, Sinatra. But they weren't really doing albums at that point.
Yeah.
They were just doing. But that didn't work out. But I really am proud of the records. But it just didn't work out. And then, just go through changes. All of a sudden, my manager quit the business. And then you're kind of left dangling. So,
sure.
But I was always proud of the stuff I did. But, you have to have a team behind you. When you see these big country acts, they have a machine behind them.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Big machines nowadays. Well, literally.
That's your big machine, yeah. Well, one of the things I was really struck by looking through your catalog is you really have run the gambit of music of styles. I mean, you've got that 80s thing down. You've got the rock thing. You got a rock album and just the big band stuff you were just talking about. How did you go about developing your style and learning to write? And who taught you how to write?
Well, I taught myself. I think I always loved music. I mean, I liked all kinds of music growing up because I really grew up in a time when radio would play a Frank Sinatra song, then they play an Elvis song, then they play a Dean Martin song, then they play a Rolling Stones, a Lovin' Spoonful. So radio was very eclectic. So growing up with that, you really had appreciation for all kinds of music. And I had the voice where I was kind of mutable, where I could do stuff like that. So if I was playing in a club or something, can you sing this? Well, I'll try. So I learned to do it. I remember one time we got in real trouble. It was we were playing in some after hours gangster club. And I didn't know anything about gangsters,
As in New York,
mob. And always these Guido guys, with the pants up to here, going, "Hey, can you play Chevy?" I said, "Not really." So all of a sudden they go, "My girl wants to hear Sherry." I said, "Don't her buy the record." Dog and pony act there. So you get these Guido guys. They're sitting there. "Hey, I want to hear Walk Like a Man." I said, "We don't know it." We had hair down to our elbows.
Right.
4 Seasons. Can you do a temp My Girl? I said, "Not really."
Yeah.
I hired wrong. But it was scary because they're gangsters.
Right.
So we would just make up stuff. So what we would do when we play bars, we would play our own material and say, "This is a song that will be released next week by Bachman Turner Overdrive." But it was our song.
Right.
But people were so drunk and stupid, they go, "Yeah, big deal."
And they wouldn't know the difference.
"Yeah, here's a new Beatles song." But they've been broken up for 4 years. But people were so smashed. I said, this is the bootleg set, man. Trust me. So we always tried to play our own music. We had,
I got
to
try that. That's a great idea.
I talked to these kids. I said, "Man, you ain't lived till you've been electrocuted on stage," which I've been many times. It's before they had grounding switches.
Yeah.
So you'd sit there in a bar and you just go, "Hey, man, how you doing? Testing." and like a lightning bolt. Now,
out of the mic?
Yeah, like because you're holding your guitar and you put your lips on the mic. It was like something out of a Frankenstein movie, like a lightning bolt. You go, oh!
You get that coppery taste in your mouth.
Well, you know, you never had to pay for a perm.
And then we'd go like this. Then we'd be like little girls going, stuff like that. It really hurt, man. Yeah, we had stuff, things flying through the air. It was rough then. It's like when bouncers would like just throw people right through a wall. You can't do that. Everyone's like politically correct.
Right.
But we played places where like the football players were like the bouncers, and they're big guys. And all the girls would come in to see us play. And these guys would never normally meet girls because they were like, size of a refrigerator.
Yeah.
So they would protect us. Everyone tried to beat us up because none of the girls would come. So if guys would look at us cross-eyed, they'd just like, almost like kindling wood right through the door.
Wow.
It was great. Man. I loved it. That's why he played Fender Telecasters. It doubled as a battle axe.
Oh, yeah.
Nice,
break
solid.
Nose very easily with those.
Yeah, you're not going to be playing like a Paul Reed Smith and hit someone across the head with it. So
I'm watching, I watched your first major TV national TV performance on Dinah Shore.
Oh, yeah.
Can you remember what was going through your mind and what were you thinking, not only leading up to, but after you're thinking, holy cow, we were just on...
Yeah, I mean, I was living in an $80 a month apartment in Trenton, New Jersey. I mean, really a roach-infested dump. I mean, we were poor, unsophisticated, playing in bars, and all of a sudden we're on the Dinah Shore show, which was a major show.
Yeah, big time.
And my brother, which it will never happen again, introduced me in the show.
I saw
that. And then I say, but he stole my cowboy boots. Those are my cowboy boots. He's wearing the white and black ones. By the way, I still have because I stole them back.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah. And that turtleneck is mine, too. So I come to California. I was wondering where all my clothes went. He stole all my stuff. So
take it back.
Yeah.
No, we did that.
Give me my boots back.
Yeah, give me
my boots
back.
That's really what the song's about, isn't it?
That's right. That's right. Exactly. So, yeah, we did the show, but it was very strange because... We did the Mike Douglas show. We did Midnight Special.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But going back to like a really desolate dump to live in, and people think like you're really rich. I was driving like a Carmen Ghia held together with duct tape.
Nice.
So I remember when my brother would come to New York, hey, you want to come up and visit? I said, yeah, sure. So I come up, and all of a sudden, you have to understand where I lived, when they saw a limo, it was because of a funeral, not rich people. So I come back in the limo, and the guys be, yo, man, who died? I said, well, other than my career, nobody. So that's what would happen with that. And it was kind of it was just very weird. So we went through all that stuff. And, when I look at American Idol and all these Voice, the shows, these kids are not really prepared to go out into the real world of music because it's brutal. And it's tough.
Yeah.
I mean, before I had my first hit record, I had been, for 18 years, I've been a professional musician. You're talking thousands of hours and nights playing every kind of venue, sounding bad, having people not like you, boyfriends want to punch you out because you just happen to look over there or something. So what happens, and that's how you develop your skill. As the Beatles, those guys played for years and years.
Oh, yeah.
Springsteen, years and years. We used to follow each other in clubs, And so when I see these groups and guys have good singing, I said, but everything is easy. You have a week to learn one song. You have a choreographer. You have a hairdresser. You have a voice coach.
A team.
A team for one song.
Yeah. And not even a whole song.
Not even a whole song. Yeah. So we do four sets a night. We do 165 minutes of music a night. In those days, everyone smoked, so the air was blue.
Yep. Right.
You couldn't even see a girl at the date. It was just like... Oh, there you are. Okay.
I
think she looks good. Yeah. She's a little blue, but she'll do. Okay. So, I mean, that's what would happen. And it's a real thing. It's a real thing. I mean, so, like, Chris Daughtry is a friend of mine. But Chris was in a real working band before he did
that.
Years.
Yeah.
Oh, for years.
Yeah.
And he's terrific live. He's great.
Yeah.
I mean, but he's a real road-worn guy.
Yeah.
So... I tell people, if you don't win American Idol, it's not the end of the world. I'm sure Bob Dylan would have not won American Idol.
Never.
Yeah.
So come here. Yeah. No. Hello.
There's a lot of artists like that. I read an interview with John Mayer not too long ago, and he was like, I would have never won that show.
Not.
I mean, I sing my songs, and I would have never won a singing contest, you know.
No,
and it's not about having a perfect voice.
How about the girl that won the Academy Award the next year from Dreamgirls?
Oh, Jennifer Hudson.
Yeah.
That was a real bright move. Oh, you got rid of her?
Okay, yeah.
She wins an Oscar and she goes on to do terrific things. But I think the preparation, it is a hard business. And I do mentor, talk to kids.
Yeah.
I say, you know what? And I said this to another guy. I don't remember thing very much. No. Good looking girl just walked by the window.
Yeah,
did my best Elvis, baby.
That was beautiful. That's pretty good.
No, but the thing is this. No, it's actually bad Elvis, but it's okay. I went and I saw. No, I went to a few of these Tin Pan South things we were doing.
Yes.
And I sat there and I saw some serious songwriters.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, if you think you can make it, I think come to Nashville for about a week. Every hotel has open mic thing. And bring your A game because you're going to need it. Because there are guys, and not necessarily that they've made it, but there's some fabulous songwriters here.
There really are.
And, you know, it's not everyone can make it. It's like, you know, I mean, I'm sure Justin Bieber, if he came to Nashville, would have not made it. Hmm. I don't think he's made it anyway. He thinks he has, but anyway.
We'll see. We'll see.
I think he'll make
years.
It good in a penitentiary.
Oh.
I think he's headed for the bad
road. He's headed that way. Huh?
He's headed for the bad way. Yeah,
that's
but
funny.
The thing is, and it's a rough business, and we have to understand that.
It is. And hey, can we get one song out of you? We got a guitar here.
What
do you think?
I don't know. What would I play?
You know.
Can I do like an American Idol, like a quarter,
yeah, sure,
a
montage,
a
yeah.
quarter of one song. I ain't lying. A little hair of the dog today. I was like comatose last night.
See, I promise you it would be tuned, and look at this.
Well, it's A-tuning. Yeah.
I just want to be loved. I want to feel everything. I don't want to give up. Lose my way and begin again. It's gotta have feelings. It's gotta have meaning. 'Cause I need a reason to carry on. I wanna have someone. Don't wanna be lonely. 'Cause I need a reason to carry on.
How about that? Yeah. How about that?
That's very a new nice. Song. That's the first song I ever Bob did in Nashville. Wrote that with Jamie Slocum over here.
Nice.
And it's featured in a big new film called Reach Me. And we have three featured songs. That means in the full length. Like the other songs I've written, you know, like for Rocky, the song's good, but it's being covered over by punches and stuff. I said, hey, man, thanks for the thought. Appreciate it. Yeah. Thanks for being sensitive to the music. I love it.
Hey, man, I had to do the song somewhere.
Sorry. Yeah.
I never really thought about that, but that, yeah,
man,
I guess if your song's in an action movie, then there's going to be
that's the worst.
Explosions you, and all that kind of thing going
geez.
On.
I'm going to do like, just like, you know, like, who was the books these? What are stupid love books? What are they called?
The
Harlequin.
Oh, the Harlequin
I'm
going to
just do that series. So anyway, just like heavy metal.
Nice. Yeah, well, you mentioned a minute ago, Take You Back. Which was,
yeah,
I'm just curious, was that because you played that with your band?
Yeah.
Was that a band song before you turned it into an a cappella song for
no,
the film, or was it
both.
The other way around?
Both.
It
depends
was both.
On what you were drinking. It was, so start out like. Take you back. Take you back. I've been told by. So people and they all say to take you back, to take you back like before. I don't call it a reason, I just call it believing in myself. And then my brother would walk through. There's the bum from the dark. Remember?
Mm-hmm.
Y'all remember that scene?
Yeah.
Do you remember a scene?
Yeah,
local jukebox.
Don't you hand him a beer or something? Or
I hand him a beer, yeah. And they handed me a contract at the end of the night, which I sold the rights to my song for $140.
Fantastic.
And now it's in a Broadway play. I could have sent every kid to Harvard on that one song. But again, that's what you call brilliant management.
Right. Wow.
I think my manager was like Rain Man.
Wow.
I said, you just sit. Okay, we're poor, yes.
Yeah.
You just had me sign away a song, and the next year the movie was nominated for 10 Academy Awards.
Oh, that
the song has been in 4 Rockies, and now it's a hit Broadway play. Thank you very much.
Oh, that hurts.
But you know,
hurts me more than you, buddy.
I bet it does.
Wasn't that a great $140 originally, though?
Well, you know, $140 went a lot for me in those days. You know, yeah. We didn't want to do it because they said we can pay you $140. That was for the whole band because we used to make seriously $125 a night.
Yeah.
So they said, "Hey, man." I said, "Yeah, we're playing Whitehorse Bowling Academy. All the chicks are really hot, man. Besides, man, your brother's like a bodybuilder. They thought he was kind of jive. You know, like kind of, we were like skinny, you know, artists. You know, hair on our face. You know, kind of like Cousin It thing. You know, sideburns and earrings. So he was kind of jive to us. So I said." Well, they'll pay us $140. Nah, man, we're going to play the other thing. He goes, $140 each. They went like, that was more than we made a week. And that's playing 6 nights a week. So, you know.
So you took it.
You dang right I did.
All right. Well, listen, we need to take a quick break, but we're going to be back with more of recording artist and hit songwriter Frank Stallone here on The Music Row Show. Welcome back to the Music Row Show. You know that song. That's Far From Over from the movie Staying Alive. Written and performed by our guest this hour, Frank Stallone. That's such a great song.
Thank you.
It really is. Is it wrong that whenever I hear that song, you just want to go, you just can't not do that?
For you, yes, that's wrong.
Okay.
Nobody wants to see that.
Nobody wants to see that. I wrote that song really quick.
Did you?
Really quick. I mean, it was just one of those things, you know. I was always a fan of the song MacArthur's Park. If you listen to MacArthur's Park, just boom, bap, 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 boom, bap. So I just had this thing. I had no idea. I said, it has energy. I didn't know it was going to be like a number one record. But the thing is, sometimes it's just a stream of consciousness, you know. And because at that point during Staying Alive, I really had kind of exhausted everything in my career.
Well, I was going to ask you, how did you get involved with that
movie? Well, I'll tell you. I mean, I was at that point, I'd moved to California. I was playing little folk clubs. I mean, it had really no money at all. And I was like,
that $140 had run out?
That $140, yeah.
Okay.
I tried to stretch it for a few years, babe, but you know, that high living, the dates, you know, all the stuff goes. So what happened? So what happened was I said, and it was kind of scary because it hit me. It goes, God, I turned professional at 15. I thought I was going to make it at 17. Now I'm like 32.
Mm.
And I'm driving around in like a Rustmobile, you know. And so I read somewhere that my brother was directing the sequel to Saturday Night Fever, which I thought was funny because I just can't picture him because he's got like 10 ears. He couldn't carry a note in a handbag.
Right.
And he's directing this movie. So I drove up to the Paramount lot. They wouldn't let my car on the lot because it was too crappy, so I had to park it on Melrose. So I walk in this office, and it's just this monstrous, huge office. Remember, this is a sequel to the largest-selling album in history.
Right.
52 million, you know? So I'm there, and, you know, and everyone's running around. Everyone's acting busy, you know? Oh, this is the thing, you know, and the Bee Gees and all that stuff. Everything, huge. So I walk in, and I said, my brother's there kind of, you know, trying to be a big shot. Always, yeah.
Yeah, you go over there.
Yeah, I said, all right. Well, anyway, I said, do you think there's a chance I could get like 15 seconds in the movie? maybe John in the John, something kind of music, you know, maybe John, you know, relieving himself, wah, 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 anything. So I figure if it sells 56 million records, I'm in.
You're right. A couple of bucks, yeah.
Yeah, 150 bucks.
Okay, wow. So get a raise.
He goes, I don't think so. We got the Bee Gees. I said, well, thanks for the encouragement, babe.
Ripped me off in the first movie, this one. Okay.
Yeah.
So he says, well, just go write some music. So I said, okay. So I got together with some guys and started writing a lot of music. I mean, a lot of music, because this was the last chance as far as I was concerned. I had to get something happen. But it, deep down in my heart, I knew I was gonna, wasn't going to get in the movie. Come on, it's the Bee Gees. I'm not going to get in the movie. Every artist in the world wants to be on the soundtrack. So something happened. And I love the Bee Gees, by the way. Yeah, so I'm a big fan of the Bee Gees.
Yeah, sure.
And so what happened was the Bee Gees quit.
Huh.
John, like, insulted them or something about their music, and they quit. Now, this is really not good. You're 8 weeks into production of the movie, the Bee Gees quit. The sequel to Staying Alive, Saturday Night Fever. And also their manager, Robert Stigwood, is the producer of the movie.
Uh-oh.
This is not looking good. And it was John's fault. So now John is like the pariah of the set. You know, Barbarino's going down, baby. So all of a sudden, so they call Hall & Oates. They want $3 million. They call Billy Joel. He wants $2 million. I mean, because they're at the peak of their career. Right,
sure.
Now.
Sure.
And I mean, and I'm sure they have all done a fine job. So, of course, now my brother goes, hey, you remember those songs you wrote? Yeah, I do. You mean the ones you rejected? Yeah, I remember those songs. Yeah. So now he's doing the schmooze, the brother thing. I'm really in trouble. I said, yeah, well, so am I. I'm driving a car with three wheels. I'm in trouble. You're in trouble. You live in a $30 million house. I'm driving like a roach mobile. So anyway, so what happened was we go to lunch over at John's house, and John's got this long face, you know, oh, what are we going to do? Because they're in trouble.
Yeah.
This is a big problem. This is a studio picture. And so my brother says, whatever you do, don't tell him it's you. So he starts playing. He brings a cassette. Shows how far back.
Yeah.
And plays it, one of those like little Sony boom things. Mm-hmm. And John, we're having lunch, and John's going, wow, man, I love this stuff. Wow. And I'm sitting there. I'm eating, but I'm like gagging. I can't. You have to understand, I have no money. So I've said, here's John Travolta. And my brother saying, this is exactly the kind of music that they want. Okay? So it's like I'm sitting there like this. So John is ecstatic. And it was really funny because it was like two caricatures. It was like Rocky and Barbarino. You know?
What do you think, Jack?
I swear to God.
Yeah, I think it's pretty good myself.
Yeah, it's really good.
So it was like I'm trying. So I'm feeling weird. I'm feeling like, okay, maybe something could happen. And I'm listening to these two guys. Okay. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, John goes, I love it. This is what I want. Because he wanted something desperate. Is he one desperate? You got it, baby. This is because the part of the movie is John's character's desperate to be
right.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
So the downside is he goes, who wrote all this stuff? He goes, Frankie. And John looks at me like I'm an idiot. He goes, Frank? Like I'm Fredo in Godfather. Or yeah. Something.
I'm you smart. Know? I can do things.
Yeah, I know that brother, Mike. I can do things.
Yeah. So the next thing I know, the following Monday, they drop Far From Over in as the theme to the movie, opening the movie.
Right.
And I ended up with 9 songs in the movie. And that Perfect. Was where the Grammy and the Golden Globe came in. So, again, you never know. Because, I mean, I was on a sinking ship. I said, there's no way I'm going to get in this movie, even though I wanted to. But is that weird? Just things happen.
That is awesome. I love that story. I love that story. Mm-hmm. Well, we got to take a quick break, but we're going to come back with more of hit songwriter and recording artist Frank Stallone here on The Music Row Show. Oh, yeah. Welcome back to the Music Row Show. That's Don't Want to Fight With Me from the movie The Expendables 2.
Yeah.
Cool.
We're
here with Frank Stallone, by the way.
Oh,
yeah, yeah. Hi.
I disguised my voice on that and just compressed my guitar. I just, a lot of times when I play, like, if a solo, I just, like, cut it loose, let it go.
Yeah.
And then see what happens. So, because sometimes it's spontaneous. Because I can't do the same thing twice anyway.
Okay.
So that's why I'm not a session guy. If okay. You're like, I like what you did last time.
Tough.
I forgot it. Okay, so I was never good at that.
Well, talk about songwriting. Are you an assignment writer? Are you an inspiration writer? Are you someone that rewrites and rewrites, or do you write them and move on?
I don't rewrite. I mean, if I have something, I think I work better if I have something, a project. I'm not like one of these guys that get up and write every day. Mm-hmm. I find that really boring. And I think you can kind of deplete yourself. Yeah, there is a muscle in your brain that you do. But a lot of times it just comes from somewhere. I mean, I know guys, they have a writing room in their house. Mm-hmm. I mean, I write on the toilet. I don't care where I write. I write anywhere.
In the shower.
Yeah, anywhere. Hey, honey, here, close the door. I want you to hear the song. But I mean, the thing is, I tried it. I couldn't do it. I tried to have a writing room.
Uh-huh.
So now I just have guitars on every floor of my house. I have them in the bathroom. I got them here. I got them there.
It's a writing house. There you go. Yes.
But the thing is, like, and I do get disheveled, so I really couldn't have a writing room. I can't even find my bills to pay. So I'm going to go, remember that lyric? I know people that are so anal. They have everything. Not me. It's in this notebook. It's over here. It's like this. I just organically do it that way.
Yeah, okay.
Everyone writes different.
Mm-hmm.
That's what makes it fun.
Yeah. How about the finished product when you're mixing a project? Do you mix differently for film versus radio?
I just like it to sound better. I don't like the way they mix movies, the sounds. Like during the Staying Alive and those, because these are still the old kind of engineers that always were. I said, if you turn that down one more time, I'm going to hit you across the head with this ball peen hammer. Don't touch the fader.
Yeah.
Because they're going, I said, how old are you, 90? Leave the faders. Because they always tend to pull stuff back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you listen to Saturday Night Fever. It sounds great because Bee Gees were probably right there.
Yeah.
But if you leave it to them, you won't hear anything. No wonder no one can hear my songs in the movies. These guys turning faders down. And my brother would do that. He would just intimidate. He had one guy was crying.
If you touch that fader one more time.
Because he kept going like this. And every time we go like this, like, hey, it sounded good. And the guy would be going like this. Slide the fader. I said, Sly, watch this guy.
Hey.
And then he went, yeah. I still got to get this thing. I just don't understand. Again, we talked about it.
Yeah.
Why in the heart of USA do country artists play Takamine guitars? I don't understand. I'm a Gibson Martin guy. I could not play a song about the country and brought to you by the country that bombed us in 1941. Thank you. Playing a guitar that snuck attack us and killed like 3,200 people. I'm really proud of playing this guitar.
I'm thinking an endorsement deal might be the...
No.
Yeah.
Martin, Gibson, Fenders, I'm good. But I can't do it. I got almost a big fight in Staying Alive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I said, finally, my first film. So Richie Sambor let me have his black Les Paul. I said, this is awesome. All of a sudden, the product placement guy goes, oh, no, you can't play that. I go, wait, nuts? And he hands me a Yamaha guitar.
Oh, no.
I was in tears. I was so mad. I was I wanted to kill him because they make these stupid deals.
Yeah.
Right.
I said, this is my first big shot, and I got to play this rice grinder. I don't want to play this thing on the stage. And if you'll notice in the movie, you'll see behind me Richie Sambora is playing rhythm guitar from Bon Jovi. I'd known Richie for years. And the next scene, you don't see him.
Right.
He got fired because he was trying to pick up one of the actresses. And
that's weird.
Yeah.
That's,
My brother goes, hey, who's that guy? I said, friend of mine, Richie. Yeah, boss is on that. You gotta go.
I said, no, man. What am I going to play?
Poor Richie.
Poor Richie. I know. He just faded into the sunset.
It all went downhill from there.
Richie who?
Yeah. Went to Cher and what did he call it?
Hey, we gotta go. This has been an amazing hour. So
thank
fast.
You so much.
Hey. FrankStallone.com. FrankStallone.com. Yep. FrankStallone.com.
And you got a new movie, Reach Me. Take a look out for that.
And Twitter is very difficult. It's called @Stallone.
Okay. Stallone.
@Stallone.
With an S.
S. With an S. Perfect. Two L's. Stall one. That's how you think about it.
And I have a new bucket list. The entry is I need to go to a New Year's Eve show of yours.
Okay.
That's on my bucket list now.
That'd be great.
Yeah. Be awesome.
Well, thanks again. Hey, we got another great hour of the show coming up. We've got songwriter and mentor Cliff Goldmacher, going to be joining us. So if you want to stick around for that, come on back just a few minutes on the Music Row Show.